You are your world-loving mountain thoughts. Therefore, God is going to be your lifelong satisfaction partner. Sri Chinmoy. Chapter 13, Marriage and Mountains. My autumn sojourn in New York had helped me rest and served to stock my inner storehouse for the winter. But by spring, I was much worse and could not work at all. Banished from the joys of running or serving, singing and meditation became my quiet bastions of hope. At its worst, my state was a living death, the sum of all my energy no more than the blue bud of a flame, almost drowning in its own wax, as though it could be extinguished by so much as a draught. There had been no choice but to leave Temple Songhearts, as travelling to London every week had become unthinkable. I had sold my car soon after because driving felt dangerous. Judging speed and distance was far too complex. Sometimes even focusing my eyes on the road was a task in itself. I often could not even read a book. The words would seem to waver and spill, making it impossible to juggle a whole sentence at once. I would sometimes find myself stranded in a room, unable to move, too proud or resigned to call for help. The rest of the time shrinking from the harsh movements of the outside world, and too feeble to carry myself into it, I would let my cupboards run down to only biscuits or plain rice. The cafe had closed down by that time, but I could not have made it that far anyway, without the sort of assistance I was too stubborn to seek. Whenever I collected enough strength to walk to the corner shop for a carton of eggs or a box of cereal, the sun on my skin was new and otherworldly. The colours of leaves in the light, the jostle of people in their everyday lives, mesmerised me and gave me a moment's release from the drudgery of illness. Everything was so much more real than it had been in my memories. There were many who would have cared for me had I let them, but I was too embarrassed to show even those in my own home how I had dwindled. It was the centre leader, perhaps the most intuitive, who saw through my guises. She slid notepaper and a pen across my kitchen table and had me write a shopping list. That same table looked like harvest festival within hours, a cornucopia of fresh leafy greens and the sort of hearty roots and grains and pulses that would actually form a proper meal for a change. Sparkles of joy brimmed and spilled from the rims of my eyes. It was as though God himself had shopped for me. Even the side of a can or a box was sacred to the touch, its contents as precious as prasad. I told her so, and she admitted it felt to her as if she had been shopping for God himself. The care and honour she took in choosing and carrying it were no less than if she were making heaven's delivery. Why had I hidden myself in self-sufficiency again? When would I learn that oneness is as much in receiving as in serving? However I treasured human company and kindness, I still had to live through the daily struggles myself, the same way a marathon runner must take each step himself, no matter who pours him drinks from the verges. As on the metal bridge, I was reminded again that when everything is taken away, something still remains, or rather someone. At least my independence had shown me for sure I was not conjuring the illness with my mind, as the doctor thought. If I had been shirking, I would have been only too happy to stay idle at home, but in reality inaction was the bleakest torment for me. I had also obviously not invented the ailment for sympathy, as I was too ashamed to take comfort in other people's pity. The outer problem was no different for any of that knowledge, but inwardly it was somehow lighter to carry. Sri Chinmoy taught by his example the ideal of self-transcendence, but he taught meanwhile to respect the body and not to harm that priceless earthly vehicle. For the master, self-transcendence might mean lifting airplanes, for others it might mean running a marathon. For me it might mean going to the shops, or remaining cheerful while feeling ghastly. Doing what other people did would be dangerous for me. If I used their maps instead of my own, I would be lost. I thus invested all confidence in my inner guide. Still it pinched at me when the routes of others seemed so much smoother and clearer than my own. Although I mustered a brave face, I felt desperately sorry for myself as I watched them putting on their running shoes, or as I waved them off for yet another joy day that I would have to forego. Sri Chinmoy also taught by his example never to give up. As if to appease my mind, I did give the medical profession one last try and was referred to an immunology specialist. Hope does not blossom willingly in the dingy light and sickly air of a hospital, but all that day I felt cradled by some benevolent force. The specialist took more tests than anyone ever had and interviewed me for a long time, but still came up with nothing. "I cannot help you," he said, as if from a script. "You are in good health, according to Western medicine." I thought I had not expected him to help, but the words sounded so final and official, like those of a judge wrongly accusing me of some awful crime. The dam of my will could not hold in that many tears. "Then what can I do?" I made out in small, soggy bleats. "You must go beyond Western limits and turn to Eastern methods, such as yoga and meditation." At first I was affronted by his solution. Was I not already doing just that? It seemed he was not telling me anything new, but I soon realized to have what I knew confirmed by a medical specialist was helpful to my mind, if not to my body. It was not so much my own effort that was needed, but more faith in spirituality and a willing acceptance of God's grace, if indeed he wanted me to be well. I could not afford to fall apart, and I could no longer witness my life's purpose ebbing away with each new breath. I resumed my hatha yoga practice from my teens. I meditated more sincerely than ever before. I looked up ancient Sanskrit chants for health and practiced them daily. I also allowed others to be of service to me, without worrying whether or not they understood me. Of all the medicines, that was the most difficult to take, as it meant swallowing huge dry hunks of pride at the same time. I was back in the office by summer, a victory I had thought may never come to pass. My colleagues welcomed me as if I had returned from the dead, which did not feel far off the truth. Despite my best efforts, I was simply not as capable as I had been, though, and soon realized I was nowhere near competent enough to command my salary, almost twice that which I had started on 2 years before. Although I had recouped the losses from the fire, I was still swamped in debt. If I could hold down a job properly instead of clinging to some unreachable standard, I would have a chance of paying off the money over time. I decided to move on with honour and dignity, rather than waiting to be asked to leave. Run and Become was to open a new branch 50 miles away in Cardiff and needed sales assistance. It was obvious I no longer had the stamina and swiftness of mind to program databases and attend executive meetings, but I was sure I could manage to work in a shop, especially in the vibrant and nourishing atmosphere of a divine enterprise. Although it was frightening to let go what I saw as a promising career, from the day I decided to make that change, I never looked back. I trained in the London shop over autumn and winter, sharing a room in Pimlico with one of the other assistants, thus walking the same way to work on Victoria Street as I had done so many times as a very different assistant. The route and title were the same, but I could not have been less similar to the girl who first squeezed out of the underground 4 years earlier. New Year never seemed significant enough before I started my spiritual journey. The stroke of midnight always augured only disappointment, whichever city I happened to be in. Every year I wondered why I had ended up rolling drunk again, outside under icy rain, in a short skirt and with no coat or hat, milling through crowds of people who were mostly strangers, and who were probably also wondering what they were doing there in the icy rain without a coat. New Year's Day itself was always just another hangover, only longer and more miserable than a normal one. As a disciple, I first started looking forward to each new year. A few weeks beforehand, Sri Chinmoy would usually give a message, like a prayer for the months ahead, and at the turn of the year itself there would be a special meditation. For those not able to be with him outwardly, there were extra meditations at the centres around the world. New Year was a chance to refresh one's dedication to spirituality, to forgive and forget one's past mistakes or broken promises, and to start again. The turn of a millennium was infinitely more poignant, and I was only glad to enter it, at least with angelic intentions rather than alcoholic ones. Disciples came to London from all over Europe for a huge gala joy day. I was in the perfect place for such a signal event, and in much better health to launch into it than I would have been a few months before. I felt my life was beginning again in earnest. Run and Become opened in Cardiff at the start of March. Stories of our new shop travelled deeper into the mountains of Wales, and demand for our services blossomed. Not once did I miss my office job. I was spiritually richer in a divine enterprise, and even materially, I was better off than I had ever been. I loved it most when the busyness meant the floor could not be seen for customers and their extended family members. Assorted shoes in their cardboard boxes, shopping bags, used socks and crouching members of staff. I could only think about giving then and not about me, so there could be the deepest sense of peace in that chaos. The customers gave me more than they knew, with their enthusiasm, or even just with their presence. Runners are a sunny species. I might say the same things as I had heard leave my mouth 20 times in any week, but to them it was new, relevant, fascinating, exciting even, and thus it was new for me. At the start of September we would hear a daily chorus from them, the tone dejected from neglect, but still with a Welsh melody. They had come the week before, by bus, or car, or train, all the way from Pontypridd, or Cwmbran, Glenavon, or Abergavenny, and we were closed. Their mother, or brother, coach, or doctor had told them they must not go anywhere other than Run and Become for a tidy pair of daps, a good pair of running shoes. They would soon realise they were pleased we were back from New York rather than cross. I had to admit I had missed them too. Their pleading or resolute expressions were always endearing enough to coax me out of the jet lag zone and away from my paper cup of latte. When we told them some of us had run races there, they would be so absorbed by the finishing times, or so fondly immersed in their own race memories, they would soon forget their wasted journeys. They would already be rolling up their suit trousers, pulling up their socks, entrusting their shopping to us, and running up and down the pavement outside to test their daps. The customers may not have known what was different about us, except that we closed for holidays twice a year. Still, they seemed to feel something meaningful beneath the frenzy. Outwardly, it always felt like a muddle, and especially after being shut for a while. Can I have this in a 13, or in green, or when I get paid? Can I leave my bike, or pushchair, or dog by the door? Do you sell cricket shoes, or umbrellas, or swimming goggles, rugby tickets, or phone cards? I did not need to go anywhere to learn. People came in every day to teach me something new, or to hint at things forgotten. Sincerity would come from a screaming toddler beating a fist on the floor. A teenage sprinter would remind me that confidence is a choice. An amputee, courage. A widow, perseverance. The shoelace man visited the shop occasionally too. We did not know his name, or where he came from, or where he went. He did not stay long, and he never deviated from his script. His eyes were most memorable, a rare transparent blue, looking out as if from a dream. A child's smile sat in a bed of deep wrinkles over a chin that was probably shaven a week before. His clothes neither fit him nor went together, but it seemed that was the last thing he would worry about in his serene abstraction. "Can you tie my shoelaces, please?" he always asked. To one meeting him for the first time, the question needed repetition. Once he was understood, there was no further hesitation. His chosen servant bent down on one knee or two, tying one shoelace or both as required. He spoke politely and seemingly without the concern of rejection, as if asking a family member. He smiled constantly, but the laces created a frown on the face of their fastener as they were quite thin and short. Then he always said, "Thank you," and turned to leave. Three of us once had a discussion amongst ourselves, having each encountered him individually. "Have you met the shoelace man?"
"Yes. Did you do a double bow?"
"No. I thought he might find it difficult to undo. But it would come undone more quickly by itself."
"What if he can't undo them himself?"
"He could ask someone."
"What if there isn't anyone at home when he wants to take off his shoes?"
"Maybe he can untie them, but not tie them."
"Maybe he can tie them even, but he just likes someone else to do it."
"Why didn't you ask him what sort of bow he wanted?"
"I didn't think of it at the time."
I asked.
"What did he say? I'll know for next time."
"Nothing. He just smiled."
We never knew whether he only came to us. Maybe he went everywhere. Or maybe he thought, as we sold shoes, we would do the finest job of tying his laces. We all peeped out smiling when he arrived, wondering who would be chosen for the task and watching the sweet exchange. There is only so much busyness one can take, though, however satisfying hard work is. At the end of a day, there was nothing better than being around people who knew me back to front and inside out, eating fresh kachuri at an Indian diner, drinking too much chai because it was just too delicious not to, laughing too loud because there was only us around, buying a heavy box full of too many Indian sweets for centre night because they were too beautiful to leave behind, then sitting by myself in my haven home, meditating, singing, and just watching the sky, remembering how I fit into it all and which aspects of me mattered most. After a year, my strength began yielding to the exertion of our flourishing shop, and commuting 3 hours a day between England and Wales seemed a waste of my scant supplies. Both my flatmates were looking to move from our Bristol home, one back to Spain and one nearer her new job, so I set out to look at Welsh property. There were no girls in the Cardiff Centre who needed to share, and I felt rather too delicate to move in with strangers. So I wanted a small place where I could live alone and where I could put up visiting workers when necessary. I arranged to have a message given to Sri Chinmoy, letting him know my new ideas. Those outwardly closest to him might seek his advice or blessings on much smaller things than moving to another city, but others, like me, would usually only tell him of the most significant events and life changes. Sometimes he would respond and sometimes not. Although I knew my inner guide was always with me, there was a tangible comfort in telling the outer one too. I did not want to trouble him with my health problems, but I mentioned them as a context for my move, harbouring a secret hope that he would give me some outer guidance, or at least a hint of how to improve. He sent back a message of blessings for the plans and surprised me with concern for my finances. Health was not mentioned, so I could only assume all was going according to God's will in that department, however it went against my own. Just as before, I only viewed one flat, in Canton, half an hour's walk from the shop. It looked strangely familiar from the photograph, as if I remembered it from the future instead of the past. I was already certain it was right when I stepped into the hallway. But to satisfy my curiosity, and perhaps to convince the agent I was not crazy, I gave the rest of the rooms a perfunctory glance. It was on the ground floor of a two-story block, small and narrow yet well organised, a little like a moored boat. At the front was the bedroom, with a cupboard under the stairs of the flat above, perfect as a bijou meditation room if I took the door off. A modest living room was at the back, with a galley kitchen at one end and a back door at the other. Even though my mind was sure the flat was due to be mine, it was the rotting and peeling back door that conquered my heart. It led into a square yard, fenced on two sides and walled on the others, just a wilderness of grey concrete with a raised border of mud and some abandoned pots. I knew with a little love it could be magical. The owner was asking 54,000, All the doors and window frames would need pulling out post-haste and replacing with something less absorbent, so I offered 53. It was accepted by phone before I even set foot back in the road. I saw several agents in Bristol before choosing one to sell for me. My existing flat had a new coat of white paint, and everything was kept almost surgically clean while people came to value it. I employed an architect to draw up plans for converting the loft and had a certificate from the council giving permission. The drawings were mounted next to a vase of simple lilies in the hall in the hope of capturing passing imaginations. As prices had shot up since I bought it, most thought I would get around 65,000. Although that was a princely increase on the 40 I had paid for it, after the legal fees, agency fees, and costs of removal, and with my cut in salary, I would still struggle to get a mortgage on my new Welsh home. Suddenly despondent, I had one more agency to invite, a new company with bright white offices and an unusually cheerful receptionist who sent a salesman round that day. We both started as I answered the door. He had worked at the same phone company as I had 2 years before, but we had both obviously reached forks in the roads of our respective careers. Perhaps it was that affinity which made him look with a kinder and more creative eye, or maybe he just had a daredevil streak. "It's tricky to value. There's nothing else like it. I think you could get 95. We could try it at that for a while and see how it goes." We tried it at that. It sold for cash at the asking price within 4 days. After all the fees, not only did I have enough capital to secure my next mortgage, but I also paid off every last penny of debt from my past. With a fond smile, I remembered my guru's prior concerns, voiced before I even knew what was ahead of me. I left my mother and stepfather a set of keys before I moved, as they had offered to make my garden for me. I imagined it would look almost the same at first, as the plants would take time to find their shape. But if God himself had taken a square of his own garden and laid it where my grey yard had been, it surely would not have looked any different from the way I found it. The walls and fences were painted golden yellow. A table was set for the birds in the corner where they would feel safest, and a stone bath for them opposite. Each plant was chosen for its easy care and its happiness in that soil. Clematis, honeysuckle, and orange-berried pyracantha already marked out their own territory, above camellias with chubby pink buds. Two choicer bushes glowed yellow-green in oases of tiny pebbles. The concrete floor had not been grey at all. Scrubbed clear of lichen and the silt of years, it glowed in squares of pale gold, like tropic sand. A bench wide enough for two surveyed it all from the nearest corner. I could do nothing but sit there in the morning sun and behold that piece of magic, alive with love given and received. It was my private paradise, for sharing only with God and the birds. I would equally run to that sanctum in both the hard and the happy times to come. I was done with whitewash, at least for the time being. Most spiritual aspirants would err on the side of clarity and austerity when styling their abodes, and for a while I wanted that too. Although some may have found my choices indulgent, I knew how colour nourished me and how crucial beauty was to my inspiration. I was coming alive, like a butterfly hatching. When I had decorated to my heart's content, every colour of the rainbow could be seen from a certain place in the hall. The only white room was my little meditation cave under the stairs. I draped it all in plain muslin, including the space where the door had been, and the slanted ceiling where I pinned fairy lights behind like stars. It was my secret Himalaya. The pattern of the living room spun out from a huge framed print of Sri Krishna, idling on a gilded scarlet dais with Radha in sumptuous red and gold embroidered silks. They wore innocent smiles and their eyes glistened with joy. At their feet, decorated with henna and tiny bells, lay an intricate golden flute amongst lotus blossoms. they sat at the heart of a forest whose perfume almost sprang out from the paper. My walls were the colour of a mango's flesh and the wood like the skin of a tangerine. The curtains were made of red satin saris woven with yellow. I heaped up tasseled cushions of rosy and sunny taffeta with golden borders. The back door, by then a pair of wide sliding windows, was decked with rich scarlet satin, beaded with coloured glass. Each embellishment had been carefully collected and sewn on by my own hand. The only visible white was in a transcendental picture by my desk, and a print of Sri Chinmoy's golden boat drawing in a huge cerise mount and gilt frame. "What are you doing?" the man delivering the fridge had demanded as I was putting on the second coat of mango. "It's a living room," I returned. "It wants to look alive." I thought it quite courageous of him to question me in my own home, but it seemed he could not help himself. I liked that about the Welsh. They were down to earth, and strangers would often speak their minds like family. I was done with English reticence too, at least for the time being. The first time I had seen images of Sri Krishna, I had found them arrestingly beautiful and familiar, even on the black and white television in my teens. My interest in him was not purely aesthetic, though. However, I loved the succulent opulence of the Hindu tradition, the heavenly gods and goddesses, and the heroes from the Mahabharata. As Sri Chinmoy had been raised on Hinduism and I on atheism, I set about studying Hindu texts to know the deities and characters he sometimes referred to in his songs and stories. It was not necessary, but I wanted to discover his world in more detail. I found myself as though transported to a long-forgotten home, as fragrances and colours lifted from the words on the pages. I had entered a magical land where impossibility simply did not exist, where honour and goodness were placed above the premium of life itself, but where intense outer beauty and abundance played their own inseparable roles. In that world, life was very much a play, and the earth its luxuriant theatre. The more I read of Sri Krishna's story, especially as written by Vanamali in The Play of God, the more the ancient values of divine love made sense in my own modern spiritual life. Right from the start of my discipleship, I knew a worldly marriage was not for me, and I was at peace by then with being single in terms of having enough company and being taken care of in the world. Still, I had left some part of that understanding on the back burner of my heart. There seemed to me an almost imperceptible difference between being single and being unmarried. One sounded strong, but the other had a drop of sadness in it, at once as small and oceanic as a tear. Taking Sri Krishna's story as a metaphor for life, I could at last think of myself as wedded to God the Supreme, not in any shape or idol or literal sense, only in the formless and nameless. As a husband, only he could be enough for me anyway. I did not tell anybody. Perhaps only I needed to make that inner step, and others have their own ways. It would be another 2 years before I understood why that distinction was personally so important, but the shift in me was in turn tiny and oceanic. It was a new gauge of my consciousness. At my best, my every day would be as auspicious as a day of marriage to God. As a reminder, I had my grandmother's engagement ring adjusted to fit my fourth finger instead of the third, where it had been living until then. There was something even in the diamond itself that fascinated me anew. When I then came across romance in the world, on billboards and movie trailers, in train stations and cafes, I neither drew to it nor shied from it, but accepted it for what it was to me, a human interpretation of divine union. From then the divine union was the original and the human only an attempt to imitate that perfect, unearthly bond. Having completed 4 years as a disciple, I could apply for a section of Sri Chinmoy's Christmas trip. Each winter the master visited several countries to spend time with smaller groups of disciples than the crowds who flocked to celebrations, to take a break from the pressures of New York, and also to offer concerts or meet with dignitaries. The atmosphere was thus closer and less formal, the weather generally far more comfortable than the bite of a New York winter, and the 4 or 5 star hotels a world away from a shared floor in Queens. It was a special time of joy for everyone. I would spend 2 weeks with 200 other disciples on the Hawaiian island of Kauai, green mounds and volcanic ridges like the spines of dragons snoozing and bathing in the Pacific. Since long striving to accept the outer distance from my guru, it was a secret delight to hear him passing my door in the hallway en route to his room, or to see him by chance in the hotel gardens. Of course, I still could not approach him, but the outer guide was so much more real in those environs and easier to reconcile with his inner equivalent. I walked on the beach in the early dawn and did not see another living being. It was the only time I had been alone with the ocean, and I half hoped my guide would appear in one of his guises. It was more than enough just to be in the function room with him and the disciples, though, learning the songs or poems that had come into the world that day, watching him draw on blocks of paper and little objects, or just roaming my inner landscapes of silent meditation. The master's soulful seriousness alternated with his cute or joking moods. Disciples put on humorous productions of his stories in the evenings, and he would often tell new ones. He sometimes invented mischievous amusements, presumably for our entertainment, and as a means of giving people sweet memories to carry home with them like souvenirs in their pockets. His new game was to take note of the first 3 disciples he saw each morning, their expressions, what they were doing, what they wore, and whether they noticed him on his way to his morning walk or drive. He would single them out in the functions and maybe tease them fondly or laud them for something they had done in the past. Sending an urgent fax early one morning, I stood alone at the front desk as the master walked out. While I was still half asleep, he was bright as the morning star, his eyes as swift and keen as an archer's. In the function he had to point to me, as he did not know my name, but he described the colours I had been wearing with endearing accuracy and noted I had offered him a smile. Later I happened to be in the lobby again when he passed by. As I had only seen him do with others, he added a pause to his journey so he could speak to me. It was sometimes his way to ask questions whose answers he already knew, perhaps because the words were less relevant than any inner communication that might go on. Although he only mentioned smilingly again that he had seen me in the morning, asked my name and centre, and made a fleeting comment about whales, those moments comprised an entire world in some deeper and more precious universe. When the master told stories in functions, I would often struggle to hear or understand. The inner exchange could meanwhile be all-encompassing, the threads of the story then melting on the air. Other times I felt he was looking at me and speaking to me inwardly, even when his eyes were closed or his gaze averted, his attention seemingly on other people and myriad other matters. Although, ideally, I would also comprehend his stories and teachings outwardly, in order for my mind to receive that spiritual nourishment, if I focused only on the guru whom my mind could grasp, my proximity to him and the level of attention I received from him, the subtle senses of my heart would recede, just as my treasured inner music did. Although I wanted to be with the master whenever I could, it was that first Christmas trip which left me certain I did not need to speak with him outwardly in order to feel his guidance. In some ways, the etiquette and other technicalities that necessarily came with his outer presence were a distraction, at least if I let my thoughts get tangled with them. Until I could be more convinced the mind and ego would not usurp the heart's nourishment, I would not wish to be nearer my guru in the world than I already was. I did not want to lose the sanctity and directness of his company in my heart as I had felt before I even knew his name. Back in Wales, my foster home, I determined to retain as much of the trip's sweetness as I could, mostly through meditating and repeating the songs I had learned. Having been paddling in the Pacific only days before and wandering around in my shirt sleeves, the British winter seemed so much greyer and less hospitable than usual. in an attempt to bring more playfulness into my work and also to grow more gratitude for what was instead of bemoaning what was not, I instigated one of my colleagues to collect auspicious signs with me throughout the day. We would point out to each other anything remotely portentous and exclaim, "It's a sign," or "It's auspicious." There was never such a thing as a bad sign, and inauspiciousness did not exist. It was all done with a generous pinch of salt, but kept us on the lookout for the sort of lesser miracles we might otherwise have missed. One sign evolved from the ancient superstition that if a black cat crosses one's path from left to right, it bodes well, while from right to left means some peril is looming. The latter simply never happened. If a black cat ever stalked past me from right to left, I would find it had one white foot or something else to disqualify it. I was out for a walk once when a very black cat came pelting towards the path ahead from a garden on my right. In a mischievous mood, I calculated that even if I sped up to a run, I could not get there in time to intercept it, but I tried. Just as I approached and had accepted defeat, it smacked headfirst into a wire fence lining the garden that apparently neither of us had seen. The cat was only embarrassed rather than hurt. I counted the event as certain proof that inauspiciousness could not exist. A tradition began that year amongst the girls in Wales to climb a mountain as the sun rose on New Year's Day. After my 6 o'clock meditation, I opened the curtains to see what the year looked like, and a black cat was already padding under a streetlight in front of me from left to right. Four of us set out for Caerphilly in the forest drive of Cwmcarn. The streets and houses still lay under a black cloak of night that sheltered countless hangovers from the sun's inspection. We left our car alone by a brook at the bottom and shouldered a knapsack for each to take in turn, books of Welsh legends and Winnie the Pooh, a flask of hot chocolate with full cream milk and extra melted chocolate, a bottle of bubble solution with a round wand in the lid for blowing through, and a torch, just in case. Tumbalan is not quite 1,400 feet, but woe betide anyone who calls a Welsh mountain a hill. Legend says there is a real giant buried under it, and treasure to boot, guarded by swarms of underground bees. The walk was all on road, really, except for a last patch of clambering. Everything would start in black, then the different greys peeped out and the colours woke up one by one. By the top, the trees were flames of bronze. England lay out raw and blue in the distant south. The sky ripened fast like a ruddy peach. Factories and churches shone like little gold trinkets on a charm bracelet. That first light was always drunk in silence. Then we would sing some hearty tune into the listening clouds, see how far the breeze would take our bubbles without breaking them, warm our bellies with chocolate and read aloud of other adventures that happened before our own. That new year there were 7 rainbows, one after another. A couple did not stay long, so they were almost missed, but one remained nearly all the way home. Another made a full circle with only a little gap, as if it were chasing its tail. Rainbows were our favourite signs. For Sri Chinmoy they symbolised happiness, progress and success. 7 was also one of his favourite numbers, so we could not have designed a more positive auspice for the months ahead if we had tried. One year a hard frost ornamented everything in crystals. Everything. Even the dirty things like crisp packets left by picnickers and the fiddly things like blades of grass. We were more hushed that time in reverence. Once there was such a luxuriant fog we could barely see our own feet. We talked more then to know our bearings, and the bubbles did not like it, but we knew the view was there at the top and we still sang. Nothing much mattered in good company, as happiness usually came along too.